And I go ahead with the lesson. So this is lesson, what I call 1B, because we're still in your homework, lesson 1, but in the second chapter. But because we didn't finish chapter 1, we're going to start with chapter 1. And I reworked it a little bit from what I had last time to fit in now as we flow into chapter 2. So what we need to talk about is remembering that God's hesed is moved by our need for wholeness. So his hesed is moved by our need for wholeness. In fact, hesed is really the expression of his authority. So this is how it connects with our Esther piece. Hesed is actually the expression of his authority. It's how he expresses his rule, which should make sense when you think about how we defined rule. When we're given rule, we do it by three ways. And what are those ways? How do we rule? We name worth, tend, and make space to flourish. That's us using his authority, but that's what God does too. And that's actually hesed. So that's a broader picture of hesed, is naming worth, tending, and making space to flourish. And how we accept God's hesed in that says a lot about how we accept his authority. So when he names worth, he's going to pay attention to us, right? We name worth in our kids not just by saying, oh, you're just such a wonderful little kid, but we also name worth by looking out for them and warning them when they're in trouble, right? It's not love when we just let them go willy-nilly and let them get into all sorts of trouble, right? We look out for them. That's part of the tending that is a part of hesed, that naming worth, saying you're worth me having to go after you when you're in trouble. You're worth me having to put my uncomfortableness aside and say some hard things. And you're worth me sacrificing for you to go after you when you're turning away. So God's hesed shows that naming of worth in all of those things, as well as the tending. So the tending is giving us what we need, right? We need water. Remember, we a couple semesters ago, I made you do this, right? We tended one another's plants. And you noticed that you needed a lot of different things for that. But mainly tending means attention, giving attention. Not saying, well, you don't want to have anything to do with me, fine. It's not that. It's, I'm going to pay attention to you, whether you want the attention or not. Which is what we're seeing God do in Jonah. He's expressing his authority through hesed by naming his worth, by saying to Jonah, I'm not letting you go. You are worthwhile to me. You're valuable in my big plan and to me. So I'm going to keep pursuing you, and I'm going to pay attention to you, and I'm going to make space for you to flourish. But sometimes making space, when we had all those books and I had to make space, what did I do? Push them aside, right? Which meant uncomfortable, and some of you were like, oh! Sometimes making space looks violent. And that's what we're seeing with God, with Jonah, is him expressing his authority through hesed. And I want us to understand that so we understand that the picture of the storm as well as the picture of the calming of the storm are both hesed. So the hesed isn't just coming in the calming of the storm. The hesed is coming giving the storm as well. So I say that so that we understand really what it means to be hasidim. So that's a long explanation of hasidim. Karen, does that help?
Thank you.
Okay.
Very thorough.
Okay. So if God's hesed is moved by our need for wholeness, then he was moved by Jonah's need for wholeness as well. He wanted Jonah not to just be a holy people, becoming a holy people, but also to become those priests to the nation. And so what he needed, what Jonah needed, was a reconnection with God. And I'd rather say a reorientation of God. Do you remember where the word orient comes from?
To look toward Jerusalem.
To look toward Jerusalem. That's actually what that word means, to look east toward Jerusalem. So he needs a reorientation to look back again to God. But his immediate need was to wake up, because he was reluctant, because he was avoiding, he needed to wake up to the fact that he had a need that he was ignoring. And his need is that connection with God. He had a deeper need, though, than just to wake up. He had a deeper need to open up. And that is to open himself to other peoples, to open himself beyond his little holy huddle there, to open himself up, because that was the purpose of Israel. And when you look at Scripture as God's story and God's story with Israel, you'll notice that even the Gospels bring this up, that Jesus came to fulfill Israel's mission that they did not accomplish, to be Hasidim as well as a holy nation. It's not just the connection with God, me with God. Remember, I've always said, that's not a whole person. A whole person is not my connection with God. In fact, you can't be who God has intended you to be, just you and God. It's you and God and others. And so God knows that this is Jonah's need, that his deepest need is to connect with others as well, so that he can be the means to Hesed for other people, be a cohort member. Remember that cohort, being in cohort means that we lift up one another, and that means everyone. There aren't some people that are excluded out of that. It's everyone that God is looking to be in cohort with. So, of course, God will do this by his hesed, by his treating us as his kin. Which it says a big deal that God would treat us as his kin, right? As his relatives, when we have not at all wanted that. And he has decided that he would treat us like that anyway. So he will do that with Jonah as well. And the first way he will do that is use his hesed to bring Jonah a very tangible need. And so he brings him the storm. So we have, you know, several years ago, we went through a portion of scripture that we talked a lot about seeing everything as a gift. Mm-hmm. This is just the flip side of what it looks like on the other side is God gave the storm as a gift to both Jonah and the sailors. That was a gift. That was his hesed saying, I'm naming worth in you. I'm saying you're worth it. I'm not just going to ignore you. So this wake-up call for Jonah is, I'm not ignoring you. I'm not going to let you go here. And he gave him a tangible need in order to reveal his deeper need. So often God will do this. He will bring to us a tangible need in order to reveal to us that we have a deeper need than that. So he might bring us to a crisis for the purpose of seeing we have a deeper need of not just connecting with him, but connecting with others. That is always going to be God's heart. He's always going to be working covenant out with us, working out his authority with us to say, connect with me, come under my authority, and connect with others. Because when you come under my authority, you will connect with others. So it's all one package. And he's not going to leave us half people. Nor is he going to do that with Jonah. But the really cool thing that he does when he does this with Jonah and he does this with us is in the midst of that, in the midst of bringing us a tangible need to reveal our deeper need, he will ignite our imagination of who we could be, of who we were actually made to be. When we see a different way of being, and this is why I talked about the Halloween costumes, it gives us this another picture of, well, we could be that. And this is why I actually like the nun costume so much. My favorite costume being a nun costume, because not just then, but even now, my deepest desire is to be someone whose whole life could be devoted to God and be, and this is how I felt about a nun. I don't know any nuns. I personally know nuns. But my picture of a nun is someone who is always being kind. So when I was in high school and I dressed up as a nun, this is all I said the whole time. Bless you, my daughter. Bless you, my daughter. And people would laugh and I would get a laugh out of it. I'm not humorous. I don't have a good sense of humor. So that was never a part of me. It was literally what I wanted to be. I wanted to be that person. And I always felt like that wasn't who I was, but it's who I could be. So God actually, in the midst of bringing us a tangible need, he often brings us a picture of what we could be. He ignites our imagination of, no, you could be this, because that's actually who you really were made to be. You really were made to be a Hasidim. So, you know, you can think of that nun costume, and I know if I would hear stories about nuns, maybe that's not what I would want. But my picture of someone whose whole life was about blessing other people, I love that. And, you know, it rubs against so much of my own personality that that I just desire that. And when I see that in somebody, there have been a couple of places I've been where I've heard a person talk, both of them were women. It just, like, I felt electricity in the air. They were so for other people. That just, sometimes when I watch Lissa, and if I talk about it, I'll cry, because to see that just desire for other people, that's what I want to be. That ignites my imagination of who I could be and who God made me to be. So God will do that for Jonah as well. His response to that will be very telling of what, if he really wants to be under God's authority or not. And we'll see that as we go through the lesson. So we see what God's doing with Jonah. What's he doing with the sailors? Well, he's doing the same thing, because he feels the same way about the sailors as he does about Jonah. Even though the sailors aren't Israel, he still feels the same way about them. So he wants wholeness for them. They need a connection with God, a first-time connection with God. They need an orientation with God that they don't have right now, that they never have had. But they need to have that new orientation. Their immediate need is not to wake up, but to look up. They've never looked up, in metaphorical terms, to the God who made the heavens and the lands. They're ignorant, and that's not an ugly word. They don't know. They have no idea about this God who's sovereign. So they are currently seeking for life all around them. Whatever is around them, they're seeking for life. And we know that if we think just a little bit, and this is what I would encourage you as you're reading scripture, sit with scripture and think about, well, what is it like to be a sailor here? Sometimes you might have to go and read about that. But as a sailor in those times, by their occupation, they were seeking life somewhere. So they were merchants. So that's what they were. They weren't fishermen. They were merchants. They were sailing to Tarshish and back with material goods. The Hebrews saw sailor merchants as anybody that was in a ship-based economy, which these were the Philistines. Another reason why they hated the Philistines were they felt that they embodied that destructive human paradigm of depending on wealth to get life. So because they were all about merchant shipping, that their pride was in material wealth. So when they saw sailor, that's what they thought. Oh, those people. They don't want to have anything to do with God. Their God is material wealth. So interesting, isn't it, that they would, that's how they look at them. In their eyes, we would be sailors, right? We tend toward being prideful about our material wealth and the accumulation of it. And in doing so, they felt that they conducted their whole life apart from God, because they were trying to find life in material goods. So they were looked on as unholy and as unredeemable. So they were just like not even worth. So really, they did not see worth in a sailor at all. They saw him as a means, which is exactly what Jonah did, right? He sees the sailors as a means. We see that because he doesn't want to have any conversations with them. He goes and he just wants them to do what he wants them to do. I've paid you a lot of money, just be my servant. Because they weren't worth anything. But God says, no, these sailors are actually worth, I see value in them. They're mine. They are valuable to me. So we see that by their occupation, they're seeking for life there. We also see that they're seeking for life by their activity. They're traveling the world. I mean, to travel the Mediterranean right then was like they're traveling the world. They're going all over the place, which for them meant that they had to continually appease different gods. Remember, in the ancient world, gods were considered to have domain in certain areas. Some had domain over certain material things in the world, like there was a god of frogs and a god of gnats, but there were also a god of this part of the land here and this part of the land. So these sailors, their whole life was going back and forth, so they were constantly appeasing to each god, which is why they had those questions to Jonah. Your occupation, this, and this. Which god do we need to appease right now? And so really what we see is they're seeking for life by appeasing all God, covering all the bases, whatever it is. I'll do all of that so that I find life, so that all the gods are happy and will give me life.
There's such uncertainty in that, because especially when they were starting to have a storm, they went. That's why they were so desperate for everyone to pray to their gods so that something would work.
Right, exactly, exactly. Cover all the bases, which really is a very common paradigm for many of us, right? We're going to cover all the bases. Even us as Christians, you know, we say we trust God, and yet we'll try all sorts of things, right? To get our problem solved. Because our problem solved is really, we feel if our problems are solved, we have life. And God is so adamant. Really, is that how you feel? Well, then I'm going to give you more problems so you see that one problem solved doesn't mean life. All your problems solved doesn't mean life. It's connection with me. So by their occupation, by their activity, but also by their attitude. And here's an interesting thing. Their attitude was one of, I will risk anything to get life. I will risk the seas to get life. So ancient people saw the seas, including the Israelites, they saw the seas as chaos. That it was uncontrollable and risky. So to actually make your living on the sea was really, these were our big, our what?
Your day traders.
Yeah, our day traders, our really risky, I mean, the high level risk, you know, our extreme sports guys. That's what the sailors were. That's how they lived life. To the Hebrews, the seas were actually the chaotic world that God had not yet controlled. So when we go to Genesis 1 and it talks about the waters, it talks about chaotic waters, that's the area that God has not yet controlled or tamed. If we ever actually study Genesis through, you'll find out a lot there that you kind of will be surprised at. That God has actually left part of the world untamed. But he has representatives that are supposed to be taming it. So Hebrews thought the sea was the place that God had not yet tamed. So all in all, whether you were Hebrew or whether you were a pagan, the seas were a risky place. But if you made your living on the sea, you said the risk was worth it to get that wealth. Because that risk was enough, wealth was enough to get you to take the risks. So even by their attitude of, I will take this risk in my hand in order to get what I think might be life. So we see that they're looking for life, unlike Jonah. What was Jonah doing? He's running away from life. They are looking for life. So they're in a position of, I'm looking for life. And this is something I think we need to remember is, when we look at the peoples around the world, when we look at the peoples in Aurora, I mean, I'll tell you what, there is a big wall between us and Aurora, right? Mm-hmm. And we tend to think of the people in Aurora as sailors, or as just people that just don't get it, or just so different. But we need to know that those people also are looking for life. They're seeking for life. And Lissa said, the refugees that come here are hungry for life. They want connection. And, you know, what's really sad is they come here and they don't realize they're entering a Western mindset that is not really about connection. So most of these refugees come from a different mindset, and they find it very strange that the connections here are stilted. But they're looking for that. That's what the sailors, we need to remember that they are looking for life.
It also seems like it's becoming a real hostile environment for refugees. Attitudes of people.
Yes.
You know, and
fear.
I just,
fear.
Yeah,
you
know, exactly.
And years ago, I met a couple who survived the Holocaust, and they found each other, long story, but anyway, they're a really neat couple. And they have a whole story about coming here.
Mm.
And, you know, we think that it was all these Jews came over and were so welcomed. Another whole story.
Yeah.
It's almost like, I feel like that's the way refugees have to be feeling when they come here.
And I think so. I think it's very, very difficult. Because then when they come here, like Lisa said, they're put into a poverty situation.
Yeah.
And they don't even have access to the rest of the world. So it's a tough place. And I think we as Hasidim need to be open to that. We need to be opened up to having these connections on a personal level, more than just, service projects.
Yeah.
But the personal, I love that when we've done service projects there, we've gotten to meet the people. And you realize, you meet these people and you go, oh, they're just like us. They're no different. In fact, you know, probably kinder than we would be, I think, in that situation.
I just think of how humbling it is. I mean, Lisa was saying some of these people are working in factories here, but we're like dentists or doctors coming here for opportunity.
I'll tell you, it's most humbling. So the family that came over here that she had lived with in Syria, he was a UN diplomat.
Wow.
He is now in a factory. And it's like
they are
I mean, I just think they live in a tiny, tiny little apartment. They have three girls. Now one is married. But and we stayed there, and I was claustrophobic, and yet, you know, yeah. So yes, it is very humbling, very humbling.
Jill, I wonder if it's almost, I don't know, even worse. The generational poverty of like people like Dale.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Because even talking to him or getting to know him, and his grandma, I feel like, we're so similar, but they feel miles away from anyone like me.
Yes.
And
yes.
Even people in my family who are, you know, have political discussions about people who are on welfare have this drastic opinion of people who live on welfare, and it has completely opened my eyes to like get to know him and how he wants to live and how he's trapped.
He's really trapped, and that's what you find out is they're completely trapped in that. So I'm hoping that this is what happens for us in Jonah is we begin to open up ourselves where God's inviting us as well, and He's given us plenty of opportunities to do that. But the sailors as well have that further need to open up and be Hasidim. What's really cool is that God says to them, I'm not going to leave you half whole as well. Half whole, that's not a word. I'm not going to leave you half. It's not a matter of, let's put it in Christian parlance, it's not a matter of I'm saved and it's good, or they're saved and that's good. No, God says, no, that actually isn't enough. That isn't whole. You also need to be Hasidim. You also need to be have God's heart for this wholeness. He doesn't expect any of us to live spiritually paraplegic. He looks at us and says, she doesn't have legs yet. Don't you want legs? I've given you arms, but don't you want legs too so that you can go? That's a wholeness. And God's heart just, I think that God's heart cringes when he sees so many Christian communities so focused, like just focused on being holy. I mean, that's what Israel was.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we are so many times, not willing to be opened up to be Hasidim, to go into the world and connect with others. If the sailors choose that connection that they're going to get through this storm, if they choose to receive it as God's hesed, they'll get the opportunity then to be Hasidim, which is, I think, one of the coolest pieces of the story of Jonah, is that when they accept this storm as hesed and then the calming as hesed, they actually get the opportunity to be Hasidim, as their, remember where their goal is to get to Tarshish. And remember our verse from last week, and all of a sudden I didn't write it down, but it says that God will take survivors of the nations, sailors who survive, to be Hasidim to Tarshish and Pud and Lot. So that these sailors actually are the fulfillment of that Isaiah passage. They will get to do that so that their occupation right now that is all about them can become a vocation for them. That in their marinating, in their sailing around the world, even doing the same thing they were doing, but now with a different purpose, they get to go to Tarshish and be Hasidim. So we see that, and I think that helps us also. Liz is very concerned about this, is that we don't go, whether it's service project or being a mentor or a partner with any of these, that we don't go as givers of charity. Mm-hmm. That we don't go with this idea that we are giving you something because you're so needy. And this is actually what God is teaching Jonah. Jonah, you're just as needy. And you going to these people fulfills your need. You connect with them. He's trying to put them on the same level so that they that Jonah understands that the giving of hesed is the receiving of hesed as well, is opening up to that vulnerability. So how is God going to do this with the sailors? By the same means he's going to do it with Jonah, by his hesed that will first put them in a tangible need. Their life is at peril, right? And for them, it will bring out a recognition of where they've been putting all of their eggs in to where life might be, and that that's not going to get them life. So for them, it's teaching them, oh, this isn't all this wealth that we have in this ship, it's not going to save our lives. And how do we know we recognize, how do we know that they recognize that? What do? They throw it overboard. This isn't saving our life. The other thing that they depend on is appeasing to all the gods, right? And so they first appease to the gods. But then what do? This isn't working, right? Let's ask Jonah to appeal to his god. So they give up the ways that they thought were going to give them life, and they go toward something else. And in doing that, in recognizing what they've been looking at for life isn't working, they are now able to see a deeper need, a truer need, and they look toward the provision that God has given them. Now, we could say a lot about this, but I want to kind of go through this quickly so we do get to chapter 2. But they look toward the provision that God gives them, which will reveal to them the truer need. So they notice, what's the provision God's given them? Well, first of all, he's given them their personal prophet. Here's a personal prophet in their boat. He's a means of connection with life somehow. And we know that because they go to Jonah. They wake him up. They don't just leave him and try to figure this out on their own. They are so willing, they so want life, they're willing to go anywhere for it. They will look for it, which is exactly what Jonah doesn't do. He's doing the opposite. So they're very vulnerable. God also has given them objective direction. Remember, they cast lots. Remember, that's taking it out of our hands and putting toward a God's hands. Now, a lot of the commentaries will say that casting lots was actually a very Hebrew practice, more than any other of the nations. So they're looking at them as taking up the Hebrew practice now. Well, maybe his God, maybe what these Hebrews do will actually bring us life. But then they also engage with conversation. And interesting that we have conversation. I mean, they're screaming for conversation with Jonah, and he just doesn't want to talk with them. Please talk with us. Tell us. And this is God's personal representative. So they're going to have this conversation really with God's personal representative, giving them a personal connection to God. And in their conversation with Jonah, it clarifies where the real authority over the sea is. And because Jonah tells them, I fear the God of heaven and earth. He made both heaven and earth, but he also made the land and the sea. So this is new to them. How could there be a God that's sovereign over everything? They only know little gods. And this is a big God. This is a God who's sovereign over sea and land. I don't know how to explain how that would be such a huge paradigm shift for them. That it just doesn't, it wouldn't be reasonable to them from what they knew of the world, but they're willing to say, okay, let's have my paradigm shifted. So what you see with the sailors is this openness, this vulnerability to receive life wherever it might come from, even if it's unreasonable. And then, of course, what he was going to do with Jonah, he does with the sailors. He says, I'm also going to ignite your imagination. But here there's a little twist, because he actually uses the sailors as the ignition for Jonah's imagination. They get to be, because of their openness to God's authority, doing what God says, when people connect with God and come under his authority, they can inspire others with God's hesed. Here's what you have the potential of becoming. So what we see in this story is that the sailors actually become the ignition for Jonah's imagination. They say to Jonah in their actions, this is who you could be. You could be Hasidim just like us. Now, do the sailors know they're doing this? Nope. They simply come under God's authority. And in coming under God's authority, they become examples and inspiration of what Jonah could be. So they receive the invitation of the severe Hesed as a means to look up. They do this, and this is just review from what we saw in the story. They let go of their baggage, of their idolatrous baggage. They engage with God's provision in the midst of that severe Hesed. They demonstrate a preference for life. So notice all of these are opposite of what Jonah has done. They say, we want life. They're eager to save not only their own lives, but Jonah's life as well. So they keep on saying by their actions, no, we want life. Whereas Jonah kept on saying, I'd rather have death than go and be under God's authority. And then they converse with God. But notice that the conversation with God does involve some wrestling. And we see that because even though basically God, through his personal prophet, says, throw Jonah overboard, what do they do?
They try to row.
So here what we see interesting. They really want life, but they're going to wrestle with how that's going to come, just like any of us would. Well, that doesn't seem right, so we're going to strive to get life. We're going to strive to save ourselves. We're even going to strive to be Hasidim. We're going to strive to give Hesed by our own efforts. And this is where I always caution. I had, last night in school, we had a conversation where I couldn't get this out. And it's really hard sometimes when you come up against, no, we're just supposed to do this. We were talking about Sermon on the Mount, blessed are you. And I kept saying, those aren't imperatives there. That's who you are when you're connected with Christ. No, these are things you have to do. Well, that's our tendency, right? We have to do these things. We have to save this person. And when we try to be Hesed on our own, when we try to do it with our own efforts, we actually don't succeed. They don't save Jonah by rowing hard. But actually, this had to happen. This darkness, this striving had to happen so that they understand, oh, we can't save our own lives. We can't be Hesed to other people. We can't do it. It doesn't work. Okay, God, what is it you wanted? So the conversation with God did involve wrestling. Mm-hmm. Don't ever think that wrestling with God is a bad thing. Mm-hmm. It's a necessary thing so we understand, so we literally experience the, I can't do it. So we see that with the sailors, but then we see them, okay, connecting. Yes, we conclude God's authority is sovereign and it is best. They call to God and they declare God's sovereignty. Okay, God, you have done what you have pleased. We see that you are sovereign over all this thing. And they obey and they actually throw Jonah overboard. Interesting, it's the same word to throw Jonah overboard as it was to throw their cargo overboard. And why did they throw the cargo overboard?
To save life.
The cargo wasn't useful for life, was it? And at this point, Jonah's not useful for life because he is refusing to be Hasidim. So we have this, and the author purposely connects those two. Same kind of thing. Jonah has to go overboard because he's not coming under God's authority and giving life. And so he has to go overboard. And then when the storm stops, they respond. So we have these tensions of severe hesed or severe mercy and gentle mercy. We always think just the gentle mercy is the mercy. And yet the severe mercy actually probably moves us more so that we can receive the gentle mercy as a connection with God. And they do that. They are immediate and spontaneous with their prayer. I mean, the way that they describe the sailors' reaction or response to the coming of the storm is what we normally see from Hebrews, right? They fear God, they sacrifice, and they vow. And the author wants to make this so incredibly stand out that the actual words here, I wish our translations were better, because in Hebrew the words are, they feared with a great fear. They sacrificed sacrifices. They vowed vows. And anytime in Hebrew when you have double words of the same thing, that's like us putting an exclamation point. Can you believe they did this? That's what the author is trying to say. This is a true spontaneous response. No one taught them how to do this. No one said, okay, you need to go to the temple and give your sacrifices. This is a heartfelt, it just brought them out. And we see that because they've seen God's mercy and they want to connect with God. So that's really important to see as we go into chapter 2 and we see what Jonah does and his response to God's hesed and God trying to ignite his imagination. So we're going to read chapter 2, and because it's all Jonah, we're not going to have just one Jonah. We're just going to, each person will read a verse until we get through it. Let's start, Lisa, why don't you start with verse 1 and then just go down the line, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and go around this way, okay?
Jonah 2.
Real loud so that Mike can hear it.
Then Jonah prayed to the Lord his God from the stomach of the fish. And he said, I called out of my distress to the Lord, and he answered me. I cried for help from the depth of Sheol. You heard my voice.
For you had cast me into the deep, into the heart of the seas, and the current engulfed me. All your breakers and billows passed over me.
So I said, I have been expelled from your sight. Nevertheless, I will look again toward your holy temple.
Water encompassed me to the point of death. The great deep engulfed me. Weeds were wrapped around my head.
I descended to the roots of the mountain. The earth with its bars was around me forever. But you have brought up my life from the pit, O Lord my God. While I was fainting away, I remembered the Lord, and my prayer came to you into your holy temple.
Those who regard vain idols forsake their faithfulness.
But I will sacrifice to you with the voice of thanksgiving. That which I have vowed I will pay, salvations from the Lord.
Then the Lord commanded the fish, and it vomited Jonah up onto the dry land.
Okay. So there's Jonah's prayer. Really interesting prayer. And I'm changing our memory verse. I don't want it from here. Once I figured out what was there, whoa, no, we don't want to memorize that. But in all honesty, almost everything in Jonah is a negative. So I really, and this is why I struggle with even what verse to do. We'll do one from four, but let's go through this a little bit. So God's hesed is not only moved by our need, but God's hesed involves a softening process so that we come toward wholeness. It's not an immediate, you're completely changed to wholeness. It's a process. And the any processes look messy, right? All processes are messy, which is what we don't like, right? We don't want it to be a process. We just want it to be tell me what to do, I'll do it, and I'll be done with it so that I can go on and do my life. God says, no, it's a process so that you become more and more whole and more as who you've meant to be. So what we have here is God's softening process with Hesed will first involve judgment. He's going to give Jonah what he wanted. So he has Jonah thrown overboard. Remember, Jonah preferred death over coming under God's authority. And so he says, I'm going to give you what you want. He's done this all through Israel's history, hasn't he? Israel said, we want a king. Well, you have a king in God. No, we want a king like the nations. Okay, we'll give you a king. Let's see what happens. And he warns them what's going to happen when they get a king. And all of those things happen. He does the same with Jonah. He does the same with us. You are going to throw a tantrum, not being under my authority. You want to have your own authority? All right, I'll give you that. Let's see what it looks like. And so he does that with Jonah, and he has him drowning at sea. Now, so this prayer here is the prayer, of course, from the belly of the fish. But it's talking about what it happened from the time that he got thrown overboard to the time of the fish swallowing him. So it's his drowning experience is what he's talking about, which we don't know except from through his prayer. The picture here, I'll only go through a few things, but the picture is pretty extensive. It talks about him being brought to the gates of Sheol is really what it's talking about. So when it talks about him, he found himself at the roots of the mountains. So the ancient people considered the world being held up by four pillars. So when you hear, you might have heard this book, Pillars of the Earth. That comes from this. The pillars of the earth held up the world. I wish I could go into it because it's fascinating.
Turtle.
What?
It's a turtle that holds up the world.
In Elisha Numa, yes, that would be. But the Hebrew people said there were four pillars that held up the earth. And the pillars would be mountains. That was the tallest thing they knew, right? And it was holding up the skies, holding the waters from the skies away, and then the waters down. So the roots of which is, I think it's interesting, fascinating, because as modern people, we didn't know that mountains actually went all the way down to the sea until, you know, modern times. Yet they talk about this. But when they talk about the roots of the mountain, they're talking about the base of the pillar. And the base of the pillar for them would have been the doors of Sheol or hell or death. That would have been the gates there. That's what would have been there. The top of the pillars, the top of the mountain, the very top mountain, what do you think would be for them? What would be the top mountain? Not heaven.
Out of the water.
Yeah, way out of the water. For them, it's where the temple is. It's the pillars of the temple on the mount, right? You know, in geography, we don't think of where Jerusalem is as really a huge mountain, but it is. It's a mountain. And that's what they would have thought. And remember, that's where they think of God's presence being, right? On the top of the mount, the temple mount, at the top of those pillars. So what he's picturing is that Jonah is at the point that's farthest away from God's presence. What did he want? He wanted to be as far away as possible from God's presence, right? That's what right at the beginning. I'm running away from God's presence. And God says, all right, I'll show you what that looks like. Here you go. And he brings him to the farthest point away from his presence. So that's when we're talking about that. He also then says, and you wanted judgment rather than obedience. You want to be judged. And Jonah's okay with being judged. He would rather have that than obedience. And so the picture, when it talks about water encompasses me, the great deep encompasses me, weeds, it actually is called, it's reeds, were wrapped around my head. That picture is a picture of a river test. So when ancient people were thought to have committed a crime, one of the ways that they would figure out whether they were guilty or not was do a river trial. And they would put them in rapid rivers, their head under that, and if they were able to survive, they were innocent. But if they stayed under and drowned, they were guilty. So that was a river trial. And they did that in the rivers, but the rapid rivers. And when we see him talking about this, that reeds were wrapped around his head, he couldn't get out. He's guilty. You see that? So there's this picture of, you want a judgment? This is what judgment looks like. Is that really what you want? So these pictures here are pretty vivid. He wanted judgment. He wanted to be far away from God. That's what he's given here. So that's the picture there of that. He basically says, I'd rather be in control of my own life than be under God's authority, which is something we probably say on a daily basis, right? No. I would rather be in control of my life than be under God's authority. I would rather say this is right rather than what God says is right, what God says is good. And that's what Jonah has been doing. And God's saying, I will give that to you. I will let you be under your own authority. And I'm going to show you what that looks like. It's death. Every time you redefine authority, there's a little death there. And if you continue to do it, you're going to find more and more death. And you're going to feel like you're drowning at some point with weeds wrapped around your head. Jonah has this desire for a transactional relationship with God rather than a transformational one. Because a transactional relationship always keeps you in control. I get to choose, right? You do this for me, I'll do this for you. I'm in control here. Transformational life says, I'm under you and I realize everything I get from you is a gift and it will change me and open me. So God's hesed is first judgment. And I think this is really important. Again, we often think when we're called to be hasedim, when we're called to give hesed, we think we're called to be nice, right? There's a book called The Nice God. And it's, you know, it just rips apart our idea of the nice God. God is loving and he wants us whole. Just as a parent, as a good friend, you don't want someone that is in trouble. You don't want to say, oh, you're just so wonderful. Right? You want to say, hey, you're in trouble. And it might mean shaking you up in some way or form, right? It might mean that. So our hesed is expansive as God's is. It comes from wanting people to be whole, and that's God's thing. So sometimes there is judgment on there, but then there is this deliverance. He gives them not what he wants, but what he really needs. So Jonah doesn't think he needs hesed, but that's really what he needs. And so he gives him that. And he gives him, I love this portion, I love. It says that at the end of that verse, the end of chapter 1, and the Lord appointed a great fish to swallow Jonah. Okay, so understand this. I think sometimes when we tell the story of that, we forget that the drowning is his peril. The fish, I always want to say whale, is his salvation. This is actually, consider it a taxi. God says, fish, go and pick up that stubborn man so that he can be delivered to where he's supposed to be going. So God appoints. The word is the same as appointing a prophet, appointing a hesedim. So I love that. God gives in the fish. So Jonah kind of ignored the sailors as this ignition for imagination for what he could be. But then he gives him a fish. Well, let's see if you look at the fish. You could be just like the fish. You could actually take the hesed mission that I've given you and go to a place that's not yours. Which is exactly what the fish does, right? I laugh because I think God does have a sense of humor. It's part of his nature. I just don't seem to pull in very much.
Reminds me of Murphy's Law. You wanted it, but I just...
Right.
I don't know what you asked. Be careful.
Yeah.
I need to get away from that, but...
It's funny, but it's... And Jonah understands that actually the fish is on a mission to get him, that this is his salvation. But I love that the fish actually does what Jonah's supposed to do. He gets a call. He obeys the call, and he goes and picks up the stubborn man. Mm-hmm. I mean... What more imagination could you be ignited to than a fish doing what he was told to do? So we have that as part of the deliverance. The interesting way that the author here uses words is pretty amazing. It says belly. I wish they wouldn't translate it that, because the actual word is womb. Oh. So, and it says it three times. Went into the womb of the belly, the womb of the fish, and then it says... another place, he was in the womb of hell, actually, somewhere else. Why do you think the author wants to use womb here? He's going to be reborn. Mm-hmm. He's going to get a second chance at life, new life under God's authority. So we have that womb here. And, of course, that brings up that Hosea verse that we talked about last week when it talks about he was in the womb 3 days and three nights. Always when we see that, we go back to that Hosea passage. That's what the first readers would have done. But I extended that a little bit more, so you read here what's important to God. Come, let us return to the Lord, for he has torn us, but he will heal us. He has wounded us, but he will bandage us. He will revive us after 2 days. He will raise us up on the third day, that we may live before him. And this is what I added. So let us know him. That connection. So, with all of that, let us connect with him in relationship. Let us press on to know the Lord. And if it says it twice, this has an exclamation point. And then God responds to that portion in Hosea for the call to connect. And God says, yes, for I desire hesed rather than sacrifices, and in knowing me rather than burnt offerings, in connecting with me rather than some kind of a transactional behavior. That comes as we're reading this, as the first readers are reading this, that's what they would have in their head. Oh yeah, that's Hosea. That's what Hosea is talking about. And God is talking about hesed here. This is what he desires. And hesed, what he desires is hesed that comes from a relationship with him. Not as an act of, I must do this. Mm-hmm. So we have this great picture of deliverance, and not just deliverance, but a reminder of what it is about. I delivered you, but I don't want you to look at my deliverance. I want you to look at me. I want you to connect with me, not the deliverance. So then, of course, we look, well, how does Jonah then take in that hesed? Does he look at the experience of it, or does he look at the connection with God? So there is a barrier to wholeness. God is going to pursue us to make us whole, but we can put a barrier up. And that is that we would be closed to having our imaginations ignited to being hasidim. How does Jonah respond to hesed? It will be telling whether he really wants to come under his authority or not. So we see Jonah 2 in verse 2 and verse 7, what he does. First of all, we know at the very beginning he wouldn't cry for God to Nineveh. He wouldn't cry out for the sailors when the sailors... We never see Jonah praying for the sailors. You realize that? Mm-hmm. They're asking, and he doesn't pray for them. But now he's in trouble. Now he's crying. Now I'm crying because I'm in trouble. My time, my distress, I'll pray. Do you see that? I mean, what you should see is this contrast between what Jonah won't do and what he will do. And what he will do is about himself. We see that the cries for self are so poignant. Because he says, I called, and you answered. I cried and you heard. I remembered the Lord. My prayer came to you. All of these are what should have happened in the first place the other way around, right? God called and Jonah should have answered. God cried and Jonah should have heard. I remembered the Lord. That is, and any Hebrew reading this would have gone, what? No, no, no. It's always the Lord remembered me. So you look back into any of the Old Testament passages, always when there's mercy, it's the Lord remembered me. Not I remember the Lord. So we wouldn't know that as English readers, but if you begin to think about it, oh yeah, I remember the Lord, it's about what I did. I cried, the Lord heard. How is he seeing God here? Transactional. Like, he's there for me. He's there to help me when I need it. He's there to listen to me when I need to be heard.
So is he not really repenting then?
Yeah. Well, we'll see that. I mean, we know the story, right? He goes, but. Right. Yeah. So, and this is the indication that we know where his heart is. God listens to Jonah and responds. Jonah has not listened to God and respond. So we have that in verse 2 and verse 7. Then we have in verse 3 through 5, what he should have been doing is confessing here, right? I'm sorry, God, you're right. I can't get life by me running away. I can't get life any other way but by obeying you, because you know what's life. Instead, he starts telling God, well, you did this to me. You cast me. You passed over me. You expelled me. He refuses to throw overboard that which doesn't get life. He refuses to confess that he was wrong to leave the mission and that running and hiding in the world doesn't bring life. Instead, he says that God has put him in the position of death. And that's true. God has put him in the position of death. But why has he put him there? Because Jonah asked to be there. So, and yet Jonah's going, you did this. I mean, we've heard this right from Genesis 2, right? Or Genesis 3. The woman you gave me has eaten the apple and tempted me. So, and we do this all, I mean, God, why did you do this to me? God, why did you give me this horrible circumstance? Why are you doing this? I mean, whenever we say why, it's always, God, why are you doing this to me? And so we see that Jonah blames God for putting him in an awful situation rather than confessing to God that he has not received his authority as life. And he doesn't say, I've been running away from what is life. And then in Jonah, this one would be really hard if you didn't know the echo. Remember I talked about, this becomes really important, particularly in this section of the literature in Old Testament. The literary echoes tell you how to interpret. So if you knew your Psalms really well, reading this, you would have gone, oh, well, I know, that's Psalm 31. But of course, I mean, did anybody see that? No, I didn't see that either. Somebody had to tell me that. But it does sound like a psalm, doesn't it? Yeah. Yes. And anytime you see that type of language, you should think, I wonder if there's a psalm involved in here. You would be amazed at how much echoes there are. New Testament too, but so Old Testament, they continually use it over and over again. So that's what Jonah does. We have Christ on the cross doing the same thing. He echoes Isaiah and Psalm. That was common for Hebrews to speak. You know, and it brings up that passage of we are to speak to one another in Psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. Well, that's kind of what he's doing. But it's interesting how he changes it. So let's look at Psalm 31 as with Jonah 2. So Jonah 2, devotees of, okay, I'm using a different translation here because I think it really brings out. So devotees of useless idols forsake their experience of Hesed. So let's stop here. Who do you think he's talking about? Is this just a big statement? Everybody who goes to idols forsakes their experience of Hesed. Yeah, the sailors. That's exactly who he's referring to. So remember context here. He's saying these devotees of idols, they're going to forsake their experience of Hesed. He does not believe that their the response to Hesed is real or genuine. The funny thing is, he hasn't seen all of their reaction because he got thrown overboard and he didn't get to see the rest of the reaction. But still, remember that the sailors were to ignite his imagination of what it could be to Hasidim, and he's rejecting that. They're gonna forsake their experience of mercy. But notice here that the translator has put in their experience of mercy is what they're forsaking, and Jonah's thinking that's terrible. What did we talk about? What does God really want us to look at when he gives us mercy? Does he want us to look at the mercy? At him.
Not the provision, but the provision.
Right, exactly. And that's what Jonah's doing. So, and we know that because look at Psalm 31. I despise those who adhere to their useless idols. He doesn't say anything about that. Go down to Jonah 2, the rest of 8. But as for me, with a grateful voice, I will sacrifice to you. But Psalm says, but as for me, I trust Yahweh. Where's the contrast here? A lot of I's, but there's an I in Psalm. What is Psalm looking at? What is the psalmist?
God.
Yahweh.
Yeah.
I trust Yahweh. This is this vulnerable, I trust you. Does Jonah ever say this? No. What does Jonah say?
Grateful.
I'm going to do something for you.
So transactional.
I'm going to do something for you. Yep. Oh, you're going to save me? Then I'm going to sacrifice for you. I'm going to do that. The psalmist goes on to say, I will rejoice ecstatically over your mercy, but first I connected with you. I'm rejoicing that you gave me mercy, but I got to connect with you in that. Jonah goes on to say, what I have vowed, I will pay. Notice all of his too is in the future. I will do this. I will do this. The sailors, immediate response, right? And what you see here for Jonah is, I will do this. He's waiting until he get to the temple to do this because he thinks, and I'm going to use this word, and you might not understand it. He thinks cultic observation is more important than from the heart. So cultic observation refers to any kind of faith or religion, the things you do that are institutionalized in religion. Okay, so we do cultic things too. That's what Jonah thinks. So that's why he's waiting. The sailors have no baggage like that. God saved me here and now. I'm going to praise him here and now. And the psalmist says, he goes on to say, who is this all about? Because you noticed my affliction. You understood my personal desires. It's exactly what Jonah could have said, right? That's exactly what happened to him. But Jonah's all about, well, you did this for me, and I'm going to do this for you, God. When I get back home, that's what I'm going to do. So what we have here from Jonah is, first of all, he's comparing himself with the sailors, which is hilarious when you think we see what the sailors have done, and he's going to compare himself, and he thinks there's no comparison, and there isn't, but it's flipped. He's going to do it. The sailors have already done it. The psalmist says the purpose of mercy is to connect with God, not to receive the mercy and then try to give it back, try to somehow pay for it. When we value a gift, the experience of mercy, over the giver, we'll most likely receive it in a transactional way. So when we look at that, we'll see a need to give something in return. When we look at the gift rather than the giver, is a payment. The psalmist sees the giver and responds with this vulnerable openness to him. I trust you, Yahweh. And it's in the same kind of situation, in this horrible situation, and I trust you that you know what is best. That's vulnerability. And that vulnerability opens him up, not just to receive Hesed, but to be able to give it, that it flows out. But if I'm in a transactional, if God gives me mercy and I give him a payment for it, there's no mercy to give because I paid for it. So there's this huge difference for Jonah and the psalmist. When I receive a gift and see the giver, I receive it as an invitation to connect, and I'm changed and opened and vulnerable rather than I've paid my due. So last week I got an unexpected gift, and it was really a fun gift. I got this coloring book, Whimsical Gardens. So now I could have looked at this and said, that is the coolest gift. I actually did say that. That is the coolest gift. Wow. And I could be all over this and tell you, you know, oh, you should see this intricate, look at all this. Oh, I mean, this is just so cool. And I've got watercolor pencils and oh, this is so cool. Or I could see the giver. And what I did see is, this is what I thought. This is going to make me cry because this person not only knows that I like gardens, but she heard me. How many of you heard that I like to color? She said, I know you like to color. She listened to me. She heard me. To me, that was the gift. So that when I look at the gift, I see the giver. And it makes me very vulnerable to know that someone heard me, that someone saw me rather than was paying me for something. I mean, I don't know how many times it's happened to you that you've given a gift out of love. And then someone tried to say, give you a gift in return. Mm-hmm. Did it not diminish? Didn't you feel almost dirty? Like, I gave you this to say I love you. I wanted to connect with you. And then they had to pay for it. Now, that's not always the case when someone gives you another gift. But, I mean, oh, we've talked about this a million times. It's definitely my pet peeve. This idea of a gift exchange. If it's, that's an oxymoron. If it's a gift, there's no exchange. A gift is meant to connect with you.
We had a, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
We had an experience of about a month ago. It was apple season when we got apple picking, and my son and I made applesauce, and it was his first time, he's four, his first time using a knife and cutting things or whatever. So he was really proud of his applesauce. And so we have some next door neighbors who are really sweet, and so I said, well, let's take some over to them, and, you know, that would be a nice gift for them. And he was all excited to share. So I sent him over by himself, you know, just kind of letting him take some big stuff. And he comes back with $2. And he's like, look what she gave me. And I'm like, oh, that's so defeated. Because, like, I wanted him to have the experience of really doing forgiving. I'm like, you so, and I texted her, you did not need to pay him for this because it was a gift. And she's like, I know, but he's so darn cute. And I'm like, oh, man.
That's our, yeah, that is, that's our tendency, isn't it? That is our tendency. The problem with that is once you pay for something, you have no more obligation with that. There's no connection. Like, I'm done. I don't have to think about that person ever again. It closes the door to connection. And this is what Jonah's doing. The problem is that when that happens for Jonah, it closes the door for him to really receive the hesed as God saying, I want to connect with you, Jonah. And so we see what happens when that when he kind of makes it a transaction. So he goes out and he obeys, but doesn't really do a whole lot of good for Jonah. Right? God's not going to waste the efforts, but it still isn't where Jonah needs to be. Jonah doesn't end up whole from that. So there's a big deal here for Jonah, how he's receiving the hesed. And that's your clue to why chapter 3 and 4 happens. But we also see, as I mentioned before, that cultic behavior versus spontaneous response. What Jonah does isn't wrong in itself, that he's going to go to the temple and sacrifice. It's the idea that it's a payment. It's, oh, you've done this for me, then I will do this for you. I mean, I can remember many times being with people and then praying, you know, oh, if God would only heal this person. You know, if you do this, I'll go back to church. I mean, I've heard that a lot. If you do this, and you're thinking, God's like, from Hosea, I want hesed, not sacrifices. I want you to become Hasidim. I want my nature to flow through you. And it's not going to be able to do that when you do that. So Jonah says the right words. You know, he says salvation is from the Lord, which is true. Salvation is only from the Lord. But for Jonah, does he really believe that? And does he believe salvation, when God talks about salvation, that it's wholeness? He doesn't, because he doesn't receive wholeness. He doesn't want wholeness for himself or anyone else, for that matter. So that even when he obeys going to Nineveh, without Jonah progressing toward receiving Hesed as his greatest need, receiving mercy, he will not be any farther along. And he won't be able to let Hesed freely flow through him. God will still get it through. But Jonah won't get that life-giving flow from that. When we become whole, when we come under God's authority as Hasidim, there's a need for humility. There's a need for knowing, I need Hesed. And it isn't, I need Hesed every once in a while. I need Hesed every single day. And I am exactly like everyone else. I need it just as much as everyone else. Pride gets in the way of being able to embody the new person that he's making me. Because it says, I don't need Hesed all the time. This is Paul with the Galatians. He keeps saying to the Galatians, you came to life from the Holy Spirit, and now you're going to start walking on your own? Really? No, it doesn't work that way. You can't be whole like that. But we often do that, right? We want God there, like Jonah, in the midst of the really hard situations, right? When we're drowning, we cry out to God, and we expect him to hear and listen right then and there. No matter our context has been that we've not been listening. Once that's over and done, we kind of breathe and go, okay, and then we go back. God warned them in Deuteronomy all the way back. He said, when you get into the land and I prosper you and you are rich and life is comfortable, what will happen most likely?
Forget.
You'll forget me.
It's hard for the rich to enter the kingdom.
It's hard for the rich to enter the kingdom. And when he means rich, he means satisfied in yourself, getting life for yourself. So that being Hasidim requires the humility and the recognition that we cannot live without Hesed. This world would not stay together without Hesed, without God's Hesed, without God treating us as kin. We could not survive. That has to be key underneath. Because if it isn't, we go out and we give charity. And we try, like the sailors at first, tried to save other people. And we tried to be kind, right? I mean, I always laugh. I remember teaching Galatians at one point. You know, the fruits of the Spirit. So the fruits of the Spirit are love, joy. And I remember thinking, okay, so for week one, we are all going to try to love. Well, you know how that happened. You know what happened there. Well, okay, maybe I'm not so good at love, but joy, I can do joy. And so for week two, we're going to try to be joyful. And this was my argument last night with the class. It was really a hard class to come away feeling like I was trying to express that. And kind of the resistance of, well, no, we have to be poor in spirit. We have to be merciful. Yeah, but it doesn't come from trying to be those things. It comes from connecting with God and saying, I can't be merciful. I can't be merciful for even 2 minutes without connecting to God. Because Hesed is a character of God, not me. And I need to allow it to come in me and flow through me. So the idea for here, when we read this, we want to read that Jonah kind of reconnected with God, right? We want to read that. We so much want to read that. But if we read it that way and we get to 3 and 4, we go, well, what happened? Mm-hmm. Well, this is what happened. We look pious. We look like we're connected with God. But in reality, we still have this wall of, I don't really need Hesed all the time. Oh, every once in a while, I might get into trouble, so I might need it. But I actually need it now, all the time, just like everyone else does. It really levels the playing field, because to be Hasidim, I can't go in there as someone who's better. I have to go on that level playing field. The sailors did that, though. They completely were like, okay, you know, we're throwing our cargo over. We're throwing our gods over. We're going to come under God's authority. And when we come under God's authority with this great vulnerability, we become those imagination igniters. Not because we tried to be, but being under God's authority, people can see, oh, that's what it looks like to be Hasidim. Oh. And it can inspire us, or we can shut it off, right? We have that choice. And the shutting off is always a matter of saying, I don't need God's Hesed all the time, like they do. And anytime we use that word, right, they, we know there's been a separation of us and them. Jonah is idolizing his cultic stance, his ability to go to the temple and do this, which is really funny as you read this, because in reality, when Jonah lived, he would never have gone to the temple because he's a northern prophet. So he would never have gone to the south. The temple's in Jerusalem. Remember, so Jonah lives in a time when there's two steps. There's Israel and there's Judah. So there's a lot of irony here in the writing of this. It's not about the cultic stance. It's not about going to church. I go to Bible study. I go to church. I'm on this committee. It's not about any of that stuff. Are you connecting with God? Are you looking at his Hesed as a means of connection with God, or are you wanting just the gift of mercy? That's what God is asking Jonah, because he's going to continue to show them that mercy is what everybody needs. And I love that on both ends, he shows Jonah, what it looks like to embrace the mercy as a connection to God, rather than embracing the experience of mercy.
Jill, yeah. I heard Rick Warren yesterday on Family Talk, I think it's a XM radio, and he was talking about how God wants us to extend mercy to others more than he wants our sacrifices, even worship.
Right.
So I need to be merciful to you or to all of you, my friends, more than he wants my soul to worship.
And you know why?
It's like, wow.
Because that is worship.
Right. Yeah.
And that's where we make these mistakes. We like the cultic stances. We like that because it gives us something to do to check off the box, right? I remember when I was a kid, so I went to a Baptist church as a kid. And, you know, I didn't grow up in a Christian family, so I was just sent there. So I never had any of these, but lots of people wore these. I don't know if anybody grew up in a Baptist church. You got little pins and bars every year for perfect attendance.
Kind of like
Awana. Awana, yeah, right. And they, you know, they would have all these. I'm not kidding. Okay, we do that too. We just don't wear the pins. Yeah. But, you know, oh, yes, I've never missed a Sunday. Or whatever it is, whatever your cultic, ritual is, that's not worship. And we've talked about worship. Worship in Scripture, in Old Testament, always is listening to God. Coming to listen to God. So that coming under authority with God, of God's authority, and being his Hasidim, that's worship. And that's going to look messy and scary and going outside of yourself. It is going to mean actually one of the things about Hesed is that it's personal. It's always personal. It's never like this big, even though God looks at people as the priests of all, you know, not just one priest, but all priests. When it comes to Hesed, it's always personal. And so we don't extend Hesed when we, you know, do these big group things of charity. I don't know how else to put that. Mm-hmm. But there has to be this personal connection, which is why I wanted Lissa to come here to ignite your imagination that we could be mentors. We could be, I always forget what she calls the partners in World Relief.
Oh, yes.
There's something partners. We could be doing those things. You know, sometimes I think the RCs are Aurora, and how many times are we willing to go in there? You know, are we willing to go across the sea? Just one last thing, and I won't go into it, but this picture is echoed in the New Testament. Can you see where the picture of Jonah is echoed in the New Testament? Not just, we always think, Jonah, 3 days, 3 nights in the whale. But the whole idea of going to other people on a chaotic sea.
Paul and
the
Gentiles?
That, yep. But, Jesus, yeah. So you know when the storm comes up with Jesus and the disciples, you know where they're going? To the other side of the sea. They're going to the Gentiles. Yeah. So there's this gorgeous picture of all of this. And God, and Jesus doing it just the opposite of what Jonah did. So he can rest in the boat because he's not afraid to go to the other side. The first person they go to is the demoniac that's chained to the rocks, the Gentiles. So, I mean, it gives me chills to think, Jesus is doing for Israel what Israel couldn't do for themselves and retelling their story through his own life. And then he asks us to go, you go do that. You go be Israel. You go be Hasidim, as I have done for you. 4 minutes left. Anybody have any questions? Any conversations you want to have about being Hasidim? Having your imagination ignited? I would ask you this. I think maybe I put application on. Did I put application on your? Okay. So here's the question then. Have you seen God's hesed in the last week, either big or small? And if so, did you notice something somewhere within that show of hesed, something that ignited or could ignite your imagination of what you could be, the hasidim that you could be? Or did you look at God's grace, God's hesed, and did you say, oh, I love that gift. That's a great gift. I'm going to tell you all about the gift. And you completely miss the fact that it was God saying, can we connect? Can we connect? Have you thought about when you get hesed, when you're aware of hesed? You're getting it every day. But when you're aware of hesed, are you just so grateful for the gift? Or are you grateful for the giver? Just an example. So some of us love fall, and we just need to go out in it. And this weekend we went to Denburn Woods. Does anyone know where Denburn Woods is? In Downers Grove, there's this small little hidden place. Nobody knows about it. That there's these houses in the middle of woods. It's in the middle of Downers Grove. You don't even know it. But the woods are just full. And then there's a woods behind all of their houses. And the woods are all, what are the trees there? They're all maples, are all,
sure.
Yeah, no, not sure, they're, yeah. They're yellow. It is so yellow, you get there and it's bright, like, whoa. And so for us who do that and go there and we look at that and we go, oh, this is so, I mean, you're just like, oh, you're taking pictures. I didn't have my camera, I had my phone. I took enough pictures from my phone that the phone died. It was done. I sent you Karen, you must come. It died after I sent you that. You must come here. Now, I had a choice to go, oh, I'm going to take pictures. I want to save this moment. Or to stop and say, God, you did this. You literally gave me a gift because you want me to talk with you. You want me to say, you're amazing, God. Well, you've done this. I could have said, oh, God, that's great, but and take these pictures and be all about that. Or I could say, what do you want to say to me, God? What do you want to say to me here? That you want to delight me, that you want to give me good gifts, that you are a giver of good gifts, and that you want to hear from me, and you want me to listen. There, it's just this little switch. But we so often are taken up with the gift. So I would challenge you this week. Exactly. Exactly. And that's when you kind of know this isn't about, because as a photographer, a lot of times you want to take these pictures and look at the pictures I got. But I couldn't keep it in. I'm like, Karen, it's got to come. I wanted to come there right now because right then was the light was perfect. The light is perfect. Come now. Come now.
And when the gift's a conduit.
Yes, that's exactly. Yeah. Yes, that's exactly it. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah, exactly it. So I would challenge you this week to look for the hesed that you're getting and notice the connection that God's saying, hey, I'm here. Father, thank you that you're always on our side, that you're giving us hesed, day in and day out, tapping us, sometimes shouting, sometimes waking us up with a jolt to say, I'm here. I'm your life. Father, I pray that we would hear your voice in those gifts of hesed, that we would recognize the severe hesed as the same voice as the gentle hesed, and that the voice is, come, be with me, as I'm with you. In Jesus' name, amen.